Thank you for downloading the IA podcast. You can listen to all our episodes on Podbean, Spotify, Apple, and YouTube. Enjoy. The European Union has set out its proposals to change the way the Brexit deal for Northern Ireland, known as the Northern Ireland Protocol, is implemented. The protocol was designed to prevent checks along the border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland following Brexit. But since it came into force at the start of 2021, it has prompted disagreements between the UK and the EU because it has disrupted trade between Great Britain and Northern Ireland. The UK government has been calling for the deal to be rewritten, with Brexit Minister Lord Frost drawing up proposals for an alternative arrangement in the so-called command paper in July this year. After his speech in Lisbon on Tuesday this week, Lord Frost issued the EU an ultimatum: either budge on the protocol or risk the UK triggering Article 16, which would allow the UK to unilaterally ignore provisions in the agreement. The EU have been forced to act, and they themselves have drawn up their own counter-proposals, starting another set of negotiations between the UK and the EU. But what are the sticking points between the UK and the EU? Why is the protocol, as it currently stands, not working? And is there any prospects for an agreement to finally settle the Northern Ireland issue once and for all? I'm delighted to be joined by Victoria Hewson, who is Head of Regulatory Affairs at the Institute of Economic Affairs, to discuss the Northern Ireland Protocol. Victoria has commented extensively on the issues relating to Brexit, especially when it comes to trade and regulation. She also submitted to the government's Task Force on Innovation, Growth and Regulatory Reform consultation, and advocated for the UK to reform its regulatory framework and cull remaining EU regulation, which is detrimental to business. So we are in safe hands with Victoria. Welcome, Victoria. Before we begin by looking at the latest developments, I want to dedicate some time to seeing how we got here. From my understanding, the Northern Ireland Protocol was negotiated to prevent a hard border from being established on the island of Ireland, as it would breach the Good Friday Agreement. This meant that a trade border had to be erected somewhere else, and the Northern Ireland Protocol agreed that the trade border would be down the Irish Sea, so goods from Great Britain going into Northern Ireland would be checked. This was to prevent British goods, which may have different standards from the EU, to be sold in the Republic of Ireland. But under the agreement, the Northern Ireland remains part of the EU's single market for goods, which allows it to continue trade with the Republic of Ireland. It's a very complex situation to navigate. Victoria, is my summary broadly correct?
Yes, it is. However, I would diverge from you on one particular point, which really is the very root of how we got here, actually, which is the contention that a hard border, or let's say a trade border, on the island of Ireland, on the land border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland, would have been a breach of the Belfast Good Friday Agreement. Now, that contention was put forward and broadly was very rapidly accepted by the then British government, Theresa May, and her negotiators. But actually, there's very little foundation for it in the Belfast Agreement itself, which the Belfast Agreement sort of was a peace treaty, if you like, between parties in Northern Ireland to bring the Troubles to an end. And it actually preserves Northern Ireland's status as part of the United Kingdom unless and until there is a referendum in Northern Ireland and the people of Northern Ireland decide otherwise. It's pretty silent about the border. The only stipulation in the Belfast Agreement about the land border concerned security arrangements, so basically army watchtowers and associated military installations that had been installed on the border during the Troubles, that was all gone and the border was demilitarized.
Right.
That was the main concern, or even really the only concern, of the Belfast Agreement vis-a-vis the border. Now, it did have some elements that touch on trade between North and South. In particular, it set up a series of working groups and committees for the Irish government and the devolved government of Northern Ireland to work together on facilitating North-South trade. Now, of course, you could argue, as I did at the time, rather unsuccessfully, that if the Belfast Agreement assumed that there was no economic or trade border between North and South, why would you need specialist cross-border buddies to try and address and facilitate trade across that border? It's actually quite the reverse. The Belfast Agreement completely accepted that there was an economic border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland and set up forums to try and deal with regulatory differences, tax differences, etc., that already applied. However, that, to a certain extent, is water under the bridge, because Theresa May and her advisers accepted the contention that we couldn't have a hard border. There would be a return to violence and terrorism, which is kind of blackmail, really, that was executed on the UK government at the time. But they actually were quite happy to go along with it because it facilitated... I'm getting a bit conspiratorial now. It facilitated Theresa May and the then government to sort of achieve the very high alignment deal that by then they had decided they wanted all along.
Well, that was the backstop, wasn't it? Was that the original?
Exactly.
And from my memory, because it seems such a long time ago, that was the entire UK would be aligned to the EU if an agreement wasn't made for a trade deal.
Under Theresa May's backstop, the entire UK would be in a customs union with the EU. Northern Ireland would also be in the single market for goods regulation. And, of course, as a consequence of that, de facto, the rest of the UK, Great Britain, would probably have stayed aligned as well.
And trapped.
Yeah, and that's really why the EU was so keen on the backstop and on essentially weaponizing the Irish border towards getting this, either optimally, it would have cancelled Brexit entirely because the whole thing was just turning out to be too difficult and sort of defeating all of the purposes that Leave supporters wanted from it. Or if it wasn't to be reversed entirely, then the agreement would be such that the United Kingdom would be in a sort of high alignment situation, a complete rule taker from the EU, which of course for the EU would have been rather ideal, because if they couldn't keep us within the EU, perhaps making us align in perpetuity to EU rules without having a say or a vote on them.
Yeah.
You know, would have been perhaps even better in some ways.
Yeah, absolutely. So the Northern Ireland Protocol, as we've discussed, does erect a trade border between Northern Ireland and Great Britain to protect the EU common market. Many people listening to this would argue that the UK has consented to an agreement which effectively severs part of its own territory to a foreign power, harming the UK's own internal market with the Northern Ireland Protocol. Would you agree with that?
No, that's exactly what it does. And there's a lot of people at the moment saying, there's nothing really wrong with it. It still gives Northern Ireland the best of both worlds, really. Yes, we do need perhaps a little bit more flexibility from the EU, but the British government's being really unreasonable because look how great this has been for North-South trade, for example. Which has increased a lot because it is now so much more difficult for businesses and individuals in Northern Ireland to buy goods from Great Britain. We've seen lots of stories about supermarkets cancelling certain lines and deliveries. E-commerce, you know, it's now much more difficult to just order something off Amazon or similar platforms and have it delivered to you in Northern Ireland. As a result, there has been diversion of trade, we'll no doubt come on to that point in a moment, towards the Republic of Ireland. Now, some people think this is great, and my view is I'm completely ambivalent as to whether trade between Northern Ireland and Great Britain is better than trade between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. It's a question of what is the most economically efficient. Mm. And you cannot assume that just because trade patterns are now reorienting towards the Republic of Ireland, that that's therefore better in some way.
Yeah.
If the buyers are only making those decisions in order to try and avoid the burdensome formalities,
yeah,
that's not an economically efficient way of doing things.
Mm.
Quite the reverse. It's adding a whole lot of extra cost.
Am I correct in understanding that the Northern Ireland does remain under the jurisdiction of the European Court of Justice because it remains in the EU's rules on goods and standards?
Goods and also state aid, crucially, as well. And so the EU's position, its very established firm position, is that where EU rules apply, only the European Court of Justice can have final jurisdiction over the interpretation and enforcement of those rules. And Northern Ireland is very much still part of the European Union single market. There's a whole tranche, literally hundreds of EU regulations that are directly effective in Northern Ireland, just as if they were still an EU member state. And that's, you know, from the EU's perspective, if EU law applies, the European Court of Justice has jurisdiction. For them, that's pretty non-negotiable.
Mm.
But it's a real bone of contention for the British government because, you know, Boris Johnson and others did make quite a big deal about ending the jurisdiction of the European Court of Justice in the United Kingdom, which it turns out wasn't strictly true because it does still have jurisdiction in Northern Ireland.
Coming on to that, when you issued a comment for the IEA when Lord Frost did his speech, which will come on later on, you mentioned that the Northern Ireland Protocol voided parts of the Act of Union. And I'd like to, it's quite an interesting point because I don't think many people are aware of that. Would you like care to explain, you know, what that entails?
Yeah, it's super interesting and it goes, you know, really to the constitutional foundations of the United Kingdom. And it also highlights a really interesting point, actually. One of our guests on Live with Littlewood, Henry Hill, made this point about how actually economic sovereignty can't just be isolated and taken out of the context of national sovereignty. The Act of Union between Britain and what was then Ireland, but now applies only to Northern Ireland, has a particular provision in it, and I must admit, remember the exact section number, that requires equality of trade between Great Britain and Northern Ireland. They are to be on an equal footing in all matters of trade. Now, clearly, the Northern Ireland Protocol is at odds with that.
Yep.
Northern Ireland's in a completely different economic regulatory state than Great Britain. In order to ship goods from Great Britain to Northern Ireland, you have to fill in a customs declaration, you have to accompany it with all kinds of regulatory certification, and potentially you might even have to pay tariffs on it. There are scenarios where tariffs would fall due on trade between Great Britain and Northern Ireland. Now, some unionist politicians and supporters in Northern Ireland challenged the implementation of the protocol into our national law on the basis that it conflicted with the Act of Union and that the Act of Union, as the overriding constitutional statute, should prevail. And interestingly, the judge at first instance found that, yes, it does contradict the Act of Union. But, and this is the really embarrassing bit for the government, that the Act of Union, or that relevant section of it, was repealed by the implementation of the protocol.
Wow, okay.
So parliamentary sovereignty means, you know, one act follows the other, and it will repeal its predecessor. And so that was slightly embarrassing for the government. And so even though the unionists lost at first instance, in a sense, that was still a very useful outcome for them because they now have a judicial finding that the government has essentially sort of almost accidentally repealed the Act of Union. Now, as I say, that has been appealed. I think they were in the Court of Appeal in Northern Ireland this week, and I think most people are expecting that that case will go all the way to the Supreme Court. In a sense, though, this is actually quite useful, I think, for David Frost, Lord Frost and his team, as they try and renegotiate the protocol, because if they can say to the European Commission, this instrument that we've signed up to, it actually contravenes our constitution. We can't, you know, our hands are tied. We can't expect you to do something unconstitutional, and you know, we can't do this unconstitutional arrangement either. So in a roundabout way, it might be slightly helpful in the renegotiation.
Moving on from constitutional issues to economic problems with the Northern Ireland Protocol, you've touched on them, but it'd be great if we could just get a sort of a summary of, you know, what is wrong with the Northern Ireland Protocol? Is it the checks? Is it the potential of tariffs? Is it the paperwork? Is it all three of those in one?
It's definitely all of those things. And what we have to keep in mind is that quite a lot of the requirements of the protocol haven't even been implemented yet. And so what has been implemented is the broad customs framework whereby businesses importing isn't even really the right word to use on what should be a purely domestic transaction, but let's go with it. The importer in Northern Ireland needs to fill in a customs declaration for the goods that they're receiving from Great Britain. And this includes, by the way, even if you buy something as an individual consumer off eBay or something like that, you will still have to fill in the customs declaration, or rather the carrier would probably arrange that for you, but the declaration will have to be done. And so there's that whole paperwork sort of aspect of it that kind of happens behind the scenes. I say paperwork, it's all actually electronic. Now, the UK government has spent literally tens, if not hundreds of millions of pounds implementing this already. They've put a very sophisticated and labour-intensive system in place in order to help businesses who would never have had to have done this before because it's a purely domestic transaction. They've put all of these systems in place to make this work. So that bit is now happening, and already there has been an impact on GBNI trade as a result of it. Now, what we haven't imposed yet, and that's subject to what's called grace periods, where the EU gave us some extra time to get used to the situation and put the systems in place, is on the full range of checks on food and agricultural products. And in that instance, it's not even just checks. When the grace periods expire, you won't just have to have extra checks on your chilled meat products. They will just be banned. The EU has an outright ban on the import of chilled meat products into the single market.
This is what the tabloids called the sausage wars, yes.
Exactly. And it's, you know, that's a catchy title, I suppose, and almost trivialises it in a way. It doesn't just involve sausages. It involves ready meals, sandwiches. Any, you know, non-frozen meat product will just be outright banned. Because that's the EU's default position. So you can imagine all of that does cause significant burdens. And we mentioned before some buyers are already trying to get around all of this by starting to purchase their goods from Ireland instead, which may well not be the most economically advantageous outcome. It's a one that's purely driven in order to avoid these artificial costs and frictions.
So in July, the Brexit Minister, Lord Frosty, came out with a so-called command paper, which was a list of proposals to change Northern Ireland Protocol to mitigate these effects. I mean, in it, and you mentioned that you know they pledged £150 million for easing, like, you know, digital assistance schemes. Is that enough to make a difference?
So there's a real sort of dichotomy here between trying to make the protocol work either by throwing more money at the systems, training businesses. There's a limit, of course, to what you can do there without it transgressing over into being state aid, which is a whole extra battlefield. And actually just acknowledging that the protocol doesn't work. Economically, it's disastrous. And constitutionally, and therefore politically, in Northern Ireland, it's causing a lot of upheaval. Because, as you can imagine, people in Northern Ireland who consider themselves British are not taking very well to being essentially left behind in the EU and not having any democratic representation in all of these rules that continue to apply to them. So what Lord Frost and his team put forward in that command paper in July was essentially a full renegotiation of the protocol. It wasn't just tinkering with some facilitations. They wanted to just do it differently entirely. And
what were some of the key features of it, of the command paper?
So instead of the default assumption being that all goods need to be declared, but only some of them, a very limited amount perhaps, might attract tariffs, but all of them would be subject to full checks to make sure that there's no GB-only, non-EU-compliant goods coming into Northern Ireland, that would essentially be flipped. And the assumption would be that everything is coming to Northern Ireland, no formalities apply, and everything from Great Britain is valid for sale in Northern Ireland. But if you are bringing goods from Great Britain intending to ship them on to the Republic of Ireland, then you would make your declaration and submit to checks. Sounds great.
Yeah, it's the common sense way, surely. Yeah.
Right. Now, obviously, the EU have not accepted that because they don't think that that's sufficiently protective, that, you know, there will be leakage of GBNI-only goods across the unmanned land border into the Republic of Ireland. And so therefore they have come up just yesterday, as we speak, with their counter-proposal, which I'm afraid to say is just a bit of tinkering.
I mean, we'll definitely get on to that. But like you say, all came to a head on Tuesday when Lord Frost gave his speech in Lisbon. He called for the EU to be flexible, creative and ambitious. Do you think, you know, that's a realistic aim to head into these negotiations? Or is it sort of trench warfare and no side wants to give ground?
Yeah, I'm afraid, having just briefly skimmed the EU's proposals before we sat down, I'm not particularly optimistic that the two sides are very close together. They're not even really talking about the same thing. The EU still wants to maintain the structure of the protocol as it stands and simply work within the joint committee to put some facilitations in place. And interestingly, and perhaps predictably enough, they also associate a lot of conditionality even with those facilitations that they're putting forward. So, for example, they have volunteered some compromise on the sausage war situation, saying that they will allow some chilled meats into Northern Ireland from Great Britain. But guess what? Only if the producers in Great Britain align to EU regulations. So they're not letting that bone go. Oh, they are the proverbial dog with a bone. And there's similar themes running through. For example, they made a proposal on medicines, which has been a key concern that, you know, Northern Ireland is in the UK-wide supply chain for medicines. If they weren't able to get medicine supplies from GB anymore, that's a really serious problem. Mm. The EU has come up with a proposal on that, but it does rely on continued alignment with EU rules. So at complete cross-purposes, I'm afraid, with Lord Frost's proposals.
I mean, it sounds good on paper. I mean, I've got here that the EU claim that solutions on food, plant and animal health will lead to an 8% reduction in checks. But as you say, the devil's in the detail. If that entails alignment elsewhere...
Well, let's be clear what 80% reduction in checks means. It doesn't mean an 80% reduction in the checks that are carried out as of today. It means an 80% reduction in the checks that would be required when the grace periods expired and the protocol was implemented in full.
Okay.
So anyone who thinks that the current burden is too onerous and is thinking the EU is going to, you know, eliminate 80% of that, I'm afraid, is in for an unpleasant surprise, because they're talking about 80% versus full non-grace period implementation, which is not actually that generous.
Absolutely not. And I mean, Lord Frost, he threatened to invoke Article 16. And Article 16 of the protocol is a safeguard clause within the protocol that allows either party to take unilateral action. And I quote, if it's strictly necessary, if aspects of the protocol leads to serious economic, societal and environmental difficulties. I mean, surely those conditions have been met.
Or diversion of trade.
Mm-hmm. So looking at that, surely there's enough grounds to trigger Article 16.
Yes, Lord Frost certainly thinks that there are. The command paper made that case. There definitely has been diversion of trade. There's no doubt about that. Some people welcome that, but it's certainly a fact. It has also led to what are the other words? Societal
or environmental difficulties.
I'm not sure.
Economic as well.
I'm not sure about environmental. We might let them away with that one. But you know, there are definite social difficulties in that it's causing great instability in the political process in Northern Ireland. Unionist parties are threatening to withdraw from joint committees and potentially could even collapse the Assembly, although there are elections due in Northern Ireland next spring. So, and again, it doesn't bear thinking about what could result from those elections if people in Northern Ireland don't think that something's going to be done about the protocol. It's causing a lot of political tensions. So I think one way or another, there is a very strong case that the conditions for Article 16 have been met. However, Article 16 is not a panacea. It's a rather limited measure or provision that allows a party, in this case the United Kingdom, to suspend particular parts of the agreement that are considered to be causing these disruptions or the diversion of trade, and only intended to be used for a limited time, presumably until the disruption has sort of been managed out. So it's not ideal because it doesn't entail binning the whole protocol and starting again. It's very much envisaged that the protocol as a whole will continue, particular offending parts can be suspended and hopefully remediated. And it also is a legal process that has a particular procedure attached to it around consultations within committees. And ultimately, of course, if the EU disagrees with the UK's interpretation of it, they could take it to dispute settlement and we might end up in arbitration. So I do understand why Lord Frost was reluctant to necessarily go down the Article 16 route. He's gone down the route of requesting a renegotiation with Article 16 held in the background, which, by the way, isn't that unreasonable. A lot of people are saying, oh, but the UK signed up to this. It's totally unreasonable to renegotiate it or not implement it. Well, the protocol actually envisages that it could be renegotiated. There's another article, not as famous as Article 16. Article 13 actually includes a reference to the possible superseding of the protocol with a subsequent agreement. So actually, the protocol did expect that there might be a renegotiation. And, you know, at the time when the protocol was agreed as part of the withdrawal agreement, when was that? Late 2019?
Yeah.
We didn't know whether the UK and the EU would actually reach an overall free trade agreement. So the protocol, people called it an all-weather instrument, that it could apply whether we had a very close and comprehensive free trade agreement or a no-deal Brexit. The protocol was intended to apply. Now, arguably, now that we have clarity and now that we know that we have a zero tariff free trade deal, there's very little risk of anything going, any smuggling happening, certainly vis-a-vis tariffs, then, you know, do we really need all of this very complex structure around it in the light of what we know now?
And I think as well, you know, the European Union triggered Article 16 with the Oxford AstraZeneca jab. You know, they were quite keen to use it when it struck them. I'm just trying to get a bit of a clearer picture. If they did trigger Article 16, is that to say they could suspend checks between GB and NI and then just facilitate free trade, and then that would then have to be disputed by the European Union in court? Is that essentially what it would mean?
Yes, eventually. You know, so if you were to trigger Article 16, if I recall correctly, you give a month's notice. You have to have consultations in the committee to try and find an alternative solution. And then if nothing is forthcoming, then you can unilaterally suspend part of it. And you're right, presumably the UK would be looking to suspend the parts of the protocol that apply the EU's customs code and regulatory jurisdiction in Northern Ireland.
And just one thing as well, because the grace periods were extended unilaterally earlier on this year. Is that not an option again? I mean, would that not become a de facto part of the feature of the agreement, that every year the UK government or the EU would just roll over the and it would be in itself a deal?
I mean, in a sense, that is also possible. And there are certain downsides to that. It does leave businesses in some uncertainty. You know, it still does leave all of the rest of the burdensome bureaucracy in place. The good point about the grace periods, having run thus far, is that it does actually give the UK government some evidence to say to the EU, well, we haven't had all these checks and controls fully implemented so far. We've continued shipping British sausages and hamburgers to Northern Ireland, and you can't give us any evidence that there has been leakage of these goods into the Republic of Ireland or onwards into the rest of the single market. So, you know, we've gone this far and it seems to work fine.
Yeah.
Do you really need all of these extra rigid controls?
And I suppose that could be reciprocated as well. I mean, I think we spoke about it a few days ago. You know, if we are happy with EU goods flowing into the UK, because we have both at the moment, because there's not been much divergence, very broadly the same standards, that what's the problem in free trade between...
Right. I mean, this is why I think the solution set out in the command paper is very liberalising, because it would entail the UK recognising EU standards for goods in Northern Ireland. So Northern Ireland would become what it calls a dual regulatory zone. I think that's great. We should replicate that for the whole of the United Kingdom. The really worrying thing about the sausage ban is that the UK has implemented the same regulation into our national law. We haven't, we've actually got our own grace period for that in GB that I think is going to expire sometime in October. We will be banning the importation of chilled meat products from the EU. That's insane. Why are we doing that?
Yeah.
You know, that's not a free trade friendly measure, we should be unilaterally. Doesn't matter if the EU bans British sausages from the rest of the single market. That's up to them. If they want to punish their consumers by depriving them of delicious British
bangers,
British bangers, that's up to them. But we don't have to reciprocate.
Yeah, absolutely. And for my last question, I want to do some like crystal ball gazing at the moment. Do you think there can be a long-term solution to the Northern Ireland problem?
Well, to be fair, that's a question one could have posed about various aspects of life and politics in Northern Ireland really since its formation. In terms of this particular problem that we have at the moment, I can sort of see a solution, actually, not least because I think the EU will probably be quite sick of this now. It sucks up a lot of resource and attention, diplomatic energy, because when the Commission puts its proposals forward, it has to square it off with the member states, which is why they're so narrow, of course, because you have to try and find a median solution that all the member states, including France, will actually be happy to sign off on. So I imagine the Commission's just rather sick of all this. And potentially, if the UK gets on the front foot and just changes the facts on the ground, this isn't very diplomatic, of course, but then you know, inertia kicks in, and you know, the threats to the single market don't emerge, and you end up with a sort of what is the expression that people always use about the Belfast Agreement, ambiguity.
Yeah,
that just kind of works to a certain extent. And there's some low-level conflict going on day to day, but broadly speaking, you just make it work.
Unfortunately, that's all we've got time for, but thank you, Victoria. That's Victoria Hewson, who is Head of Regulatory Affairs at the Institute for Economic Affairs. Thank you very much for listening. We hope you join us again soon.
Thank you.
Cheers. Thank you for listening. If you like what you heard, please subscribe to the IA podcast on Podbean, Spotify, or Apple. We also upload our podcast on our YouTube channel, IEA London. If you want to help contribute to the IEA's digital output, please support us on Patreon, where you can benefit from exclusive membership perks whilst helping us continue to produce stimulating educational output. To become an online patron, click the link in the show notes.